Hi, everybody. Today, our favorite girl has come back to us. I really shouldn't go so long without a Jessifix. Here today, weighing in on this season, therapy in the courtroom, jury problems, the volume of her family, and her general displeasure with too much physical contact, is Getting Off's own Jessa Nicholson Getz. Today's topic is psychiatry, psychology, mental health in the courtroom. And it's going to be what I imagine a sort of freewheeling discussion. Are you into it?
I'm totally into it.
Okay, great. I know you are buried with work and your podcast, and you said you were going to, you know, spend some time thinking about your experiences. Did you happen to think of anything on topic?
So, yeah. So there are there are a few different ways that we can go with this. There are three areas in my practice that I most commonly call on psychologists or psychiatrists. And those are in the context of evaluating whether or not someone is competent to stand trial, in evaluating whether or not someone has a viable NGI or not guilty by reason of mental defect defense. And then I have a lot of clients submit to psychosexual evaluations, where it's a combination of trying to assess the risk of reoffending, along with gathering background information and doing some IQ testing, personality disorder screening. So sort of like a full psych workup plus the sexual history and the scoring for sexual recidivism. So those are sort of the three main areas in which I have them.
It's interesting that IQ is a part of that.
Yeah,
I guess it's just the full profile.
Yeah, it just kind of gives you a bigger picture of what the client looks like. Mm-hmm. I've never had a psychologist or psychiatrist buy a client of mine underwear.
Weird? Like they're the whole the actual Ralph Greens and Marilyn Monroe history. Like I took a very small amount of poetic license with that. It was weird.
That's what I've been kind of learning, because in terms of this season, I didn't know very much about Marilyn Monroe's death. So I've kind of been doing reading as I go, as I listen, just to see, how far sort of afield you go.
I was so hoping people would do that. Thank you.
Yeah. just for my own curiosity, because I love source material. Mm-hmm. And so then what I have come to understand about her relationship with her psychiatrist is that, it pretty much looked like that, right down to this whole good father thing.
Yeah. Creepy.
So creepy.
I wonder, all right, so this was at a time, right, when psychiatry was really having this heyday when it came to Freud and psychoanalysis, and everyone was just really dialing in, and it was the hot method of treatment. And, a lot of Freud's thinking and philosophy has kind of been debunked since then. But I feel like it was this opportunity for a lot of fraudulent people and egotists to take advantage of clients. And maybe I'm guessing that because of this, specific set of circumstances I've been examining for so long, but it was just, I don't think it was a great time to be in therapy.
No. And I think, there are some pretty obvious, there are some pretty obvious flaws in some of the Freudian concepts with regard to, modern day gender politics and gender equality issues.
Oh yeah. That's well phrased.
that was like the nicest way I could find to say that.
It was so eloquent. Well done.
It's been really interesting to hear about that. Now, one thing that I don't think has changed very much is the prescribing of multiple medications and perhaps the overprescribing of psychotropic medications. That I think we still see pretty consistently.
That's interesting, because I think a lot of people would have attributed that to, oh, well, old Hollywood, Valley of the Dolls, everyone was on pills, but that's not the case anymore. But maybe because the pills have changed doesn't mean that the culture of overprescription has changed.
Right. And I think that's exactly it, is I think, you know, she was probably before the development of what the modern SSRI stuff looks like in terms of the drugs. And obviously they treated her with a lot more of the benzodiazepine sort of flavor of right. things. But, you know, I do think that the overprescription is still an issue. And what is curious, I guess, is a lot of times what I see with patients that, you know, like people who become clients of mine that were someone's patient that have developed a dependency on a drug that was prescribed, you know, nowadays that the most common one is some type of opioid. That's what we run into the absolute most. And that's also why we've seen a rise in heroin related overdose deaths and charges, because people will start with a prescription, a valid painkiller prescription, because they have an injury and ultimately are no longer able to refill that opiate prescription. And so they seek out street drugs to manage pain. Mm-hmm. And so when I have been listening to this season, I've kind of had thoughts about that. And one of the things that is a big topic for debate and discussion in the criminal defense field are these len bias homicides, where if somebody dies of a drug overdose, you can be charged with reckless homicide for having provided them the drug. And what is so interesting to me about this season as set in modern times is that's essentially what this is, except, you know, we don't see doctors who prescribe opiates regularly being charged with these types of crimes. We see street dealers. We see people who sell, you know, heroin or even the Oxycontin pills and things on the street being prosecuted for these reckless homicides. But to take it to having the doctor stand trial is a really interesting concept to me.
That's interesting. You know, I'm kind of a tangent. I'm really into the show Lou Grant right now, which is a spinoff of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, because I love old television.
I remember Lou.
Do you remember Lou? All right. Lou Grant is on Hulu now. You guys should definitely check it out.
Good to know.
Yeah. They do this episode, and it's about this doctor who's prescribing speed and to college kids and sort of on the down low. And it seems to be this new problem in the 70s that people are waking up to. Like, what do you mean a doctor is prescribing this kind of substance to children, basically? And it's interesting to look at it from that perspective, when the problem maybe started, if not arising in the first place, at least arising in our public consciousness now to today, when it is still in the same vein. I mean, a lot of people, I think, are not very aware of liberties being taken by medical professionals. And that being said, I've also spoken to someone who he has a legitimate nerve issue, like an ongoing lifelong nerve disability, and he's in pain a lot of the time. And so he kind of relies on various painkillers. But the druggists will withhold, sometimes lie to him about the amount of, like, the quantity of pills in their pharmacy, and will not disperse that medication to him because there's such a stigma about that medication. So it's a really complex issue. I don't know how to navigate it. I think in this season, if Dr. Stowe had been accused of just overprescription, it would kind of be an open and shut case.
Right.
I think that could be proven. I mean, it definitely seems to be the case. I mean, she clearly had a ton of pills in her possession at the time she died. Marilyn Monroe, I'm talking about. She had bottles and bottles, and she was getting them from not only Greenson, but more than one other medical professional, too. Anyway.
Right, which wouldn't, you know, which certainly wouldn't be uncommon for somebody who had drug-seeking behavior to bounce around from doctor to doctor to get those prescriptions. And I expect that that was probably even easier to do back then than it is now, because now all of the pharmacy records are hyper computerized. And back then it probably was much easier to do, especially if you're somebody who's flying from coast to coast regularly. And so you've got a whole section of treatment providers on each end of the country.
Right.
It wouldn't surprise me that they're not regularly communicating.
Right. I've heard people draw parallels between the Maryland case and the Michael Jackson case.
Sure.
I'm not as familiar with that one, but.
Well, and Anna Nicole Smith, I think there was an overprescription issue too, if I'm recalling correctly. Like, fact check that. I think there's still sort of an element of Hollywood, people make a lot of allowances for celebrity.
Yes. I think it's generally true. Things are easier to get if you have celebrity on your side.
I think so too. And I think that people don't, even professionals, get maybe a little starstruck and they're inclined to say, well, if it's a close call, obviously it's not like I sit here thinking that your average doctor is like, I'm just going to dope somebody up to high holy hell. Like, obviously, I believe that most doctors are very cautious and thoughtful about the way that they handle prescriptions. Mm-hmm. But, there definitely are the Dr. Stowe's of the world.
Right.
That you have to wonder what's going on there. And it's just such a particularly bizarre situation, because the line between professional ethics and personal relationship is so far gone in this fact pattern.
Mm-hmm.
In Wisconsin, it's a felony to have a sexual relationship with a patient of yours if you're a therapist. There's a specific statute just about that.
Really?
Now, I understand. Yes. Now, I understand that no one can say for sure, as I understood the testimony listening to this season, that it's like, well, okay, they were having candlelight dinners, he bought her underwear, but nobody ever saw them kissing. I think that there's a pretty strong inference that there was a romantic relationship going on there.
Right.
But, I understand that that's also not been proven necessarily.
Right. It's interesting. I think sometimes things can be sexual without sex, like, actually being involved, intercourse being involved.
Well, especially when you're talking about a doctor-patient relationship in the field of psychology. I mean, that's such an intimate relationship.
Yeah.
It's a very vulnerable position for a patient. And there's a lot of room for someone to abuse that trust if they're so inclined to do it.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question. And this is a true story. So when I was 15, 16, I started seeing a psychologist, and this guy was the leader in the field in my hometown. Like, he was a very prominent and well-respected professional. And he specialized in adolescent girls, I think, it was hard to find. I mean, you typically see people specializing in children or various adult issues, but he seemed like well-suited for me. And so I started seeing him, and I had a great therapeutic experience. It was all positive. I never felt uncomfortable. I never felt like anything was wrong. And I only seemed to benefit from my time under his treatment. However, looking back, I wonder about a couple of things, because there was a day that he gave me a foot massage.
Huh.
Yeah. Like, I was sitting on his couch and I kind of had, I can't remember if I had my feet on the couch or not, but, and he was sitting on his chair, and then he came over to the couch and sat down next to me and put my feet in his lap. And then he took off my shoes and just started massaging my feet kind of randomly. And I remember laughing because it was random to me and unexpected.
Yeah. Really random and unexpected.
Yeah. But he gave me a foot massage, and that was it. And then the only other thing I remember happening that was a little peculiar And at the time, it was totally innocent. It struck me as totally innocent, but I would wear kind of crazy clothing at that time, and or maybe according to him. And when I would come in, he would have me like turn around for him so he could see my outfits, because he'd like remark on my outfits and then like, you know, turn around and let me see that. And it seemed so innocent, and maybe it was. But if I mention the foot massage to a grown up these days, it's like, whoa, that's bizarre.
And well, I think, yeah, you know, I mean, that certainly is bizarre to me as I sit here today. But, you know, we also, I mean, I remember having teachers in high school that would give me a hug if I was having a bad day. And now, like, we don't allow any of that.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I don't think that, like, as I look back on that, I don't think my teachers were, you know, trying to sexually assault me. Like, I think they were just trying to be comforting mentors.
Right.
When I had bad days in high school. But now, you know, that can really get you in trouble. So
that's true. There's so many restrictions when it comes to touch in general. Yeah,
I think when in doubt, probably don't touch somebody you have a professional relationship with. Yeah. I feel pretty good about that. Other than a handshake, like I think that's probably the way to roll.
Yeah, that is the safest ground to tread. I agree. Pearls of wisdom from a sensitive crimes defense attorney. When in doubt, don't touch.
Just don't touch people unless you just ever really. It doesn't have to be professionally. Just stop
doing that.
Just stop touching people unless they've expressly said that they would like you to touch them. Just stop doing that.
Just stop. That's... Yeah. Which is, it's actually funny because I used to be a massage therapist, and I learned in that field that touch is something that is so rare these days. The only time that we're really touched, I mean, look at the way a baby responds to touch. If you don't touch a baby a lot and they get that, if they don't get that physical contact on a regular basis, that kid will be fucked up. They develop these like really bad mechanisms for coping. And it's just something that we as a species need in order to be well balanced. And I don't think that that completely goes away as we grow older. But when we're adults in our society, the only times that it's safe to touch one another is a handshake. Or if you're in a physically intimate space, a sexual space with someone, and there's that reciprocity that's expected, you're typically not only receiving touch. And so I learned when I was a massage therapist how important it was for people to receive therapeutic touch, because that's one of the only environments that they're able to only receive.
That's something that over and over and over again, I hear about as one of the most painful aspects of incarceration is the lack of human contact, because every facility is different in terms of, do you get face-to-face contact visits or do you get behind the glass visits or how does that work? And there are many facilities that do not allow any touching, you know, I mean, it makes me think of Arrested Development, the, you know, no touching joke that they had. Yeah. But that's, you know, that comes from somewhere. And that's something that is one of the hardest things for people to adjust to. I think that they don't realize, maybe you don't realize how much you need it until you don't have access to it.
Yeah. I think it would mess me up a lot if I were in those circumstances.
Yeah. I'm kind of laughing to myself because my husband comes from a family where everybody hugs hello and hugs goodbye, and there's lots of hugging, and everyone's very physically affectionate. And my family, we're like, our German roots show. You know what I mean? Where like the space bubble for most people is 3 feet, but for the Germans, it's like 6 feet. That's totally my family. We're like, we do not ever
just
touch.
Nodding at each other from across the room. Father.
Yeah, we're like waving awkwardly, distantly. You know, we're just not a touchy-feely group. And so it was actually really overwhelming to me when I first started to, go on, you know, trips with my husband's family because I was like, wow, this is just like a lot of contact, a lot more contact than I'm used to. But it's nice. It's just,
have you grown to love it?
I've grown to appreciate it more. It's still very different than my family. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he and I joke about that all the time where he's like, you know, some people actually enjoy physical affection. Because all
some people are made of stone.
Right. He'll like put his hand on my shoulder and I'll be like, why did you do that? And he's like, I was just trying to be nice to you. And I'm like, yeah, okay. That's not how I express myself.
That's funny.
But I
always wish that I grew up in a family that yelled or screamed or expressed themselves verbally. I come from the WASPy form of passive aggression and just silence and harboring and festering. And no one ever says anything or expresses themselves until maybe occasionally once a decade someone will blow up and just totally erupt and ruin everyone's year. Other than that, it's just not that physically or not that verbally expressive.
So you have like one really dramatic Thanksgiving once every 8 years.
And right.
Nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing for several. Just awkward dinners.
Yeah. My family, I mean, let me put it this way. My parents regularly joke that I'm the quiet one. So
I love it.
That gives you an idea of like what that setup looks like.
Wow, so
we're chatty. We're a chatty group. So what we
would you say you come from an opinionated group?
Oh, absolutely.
Of outspeakers?
Yes, major outspeakers.
That's so healthy.
Yeah, so what we lack in physical contact, we make up for in being just obnoxious pains in the ass.
You may not feel me, but by God, you will hear me.
Yes, indeed. You will. I will be heard.
Hey guys, do you want to talk about underwear? I do. So I've been reflecting on my past underwear experiences, and I realized that when I've shopped for underwear in the past, I had to choose between something sexy or flattering for someone else, or something super functional and definitely not flattering, but very comfortable for just me. And that was my underwear life, my underwear spectrum. I didn't really know or experience space between those two oppositional styles. And then Tomboy X showed up, and it was like, oh, hey Chelsea, do you want to stop doing that and check out our super progressive line of fun and irreverent underwear? And I thought, yeah, I do, Tomboy X. Here's their deal. Tomboy X doesn't conform to rigid size or gender expectations. Everything comes from X small to 4X, and Tomboy X has a collection that represents everybody, no matter where they fall on the size or gender spectrum. It prioritizes form and function above frills and conventionality. This is some evolved underwear, guys. Everything I've tried from them is so comfortable, and it all makes me feel confident. Which is, what else do you want in underwear? That's it for me. Comfort and confidence, and some really fun prints. Go to tomboyx.com/deliberations and check out their special bundles and pack pricing. And Deliberations listeners get an extra 15% off with code DELIBERATIONS. Again, code DELIBERATIONS for an extra 15% off. Ditch whatever you're wearing for a pair of Tomboy X underwear. Go to tomboyx.com/deliberations. Oh, I'm sorry to have strayed so far off topic.
No, I was going to say, let me go back to your season now. Like, let's try and...
All right,
I totally wandered off.
No,
I
was dragging you away.
So here are just some things that, and I haven't listened to, I'm one jury behind. So the most recent episode, I haven't heard that one yet.
That's fine.
But
thank you for listening at all, by the way.
Well, I love it. And I think this has been really engaging, particularly I'm loving all of like the interpersonal drama with the jurors.
Oh, good. Thank you. They really,
like, it's cracking me up. I
feel like that's their favorite part to do, is the personal improv. I'll just throw it at them and they're amazing. This is a really talented group.
Yeah, they're great. I think I really think all of them are great. And I think the tension, you know, that I don't want to sit by him or he's just going to start in on me. And then the little romantic interlude, it's all really entertaining. And it's something that, you know, again, as a lawyer, you just sort of always suspect that things might look like that. Mm-hmm. But it's fun to really feel like you have an inside look into it. I've enjoyed it. I also really enjoyed, and I thought, their discussion about the medical evidence was very true to life, in that I can completely understand how a jury would feel completely unqualified to sort out what to believe in terms of dueling medical experts.
Yes, I agree. I'm conflicted. When I was just doing the research over Marilyn, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, I felt so conflicted because I just would research contradicting opinions and statements, and I threw my hands up, and so I kind of tried to structure, you know, the season to reflect that. I think the jury would feel similarly frustrated.
Well, and you know, we've had that. I mean, all right, so I'm going to talk about an example that is actually one of my colleagues. But that there was an issue, there was a question about epilepsy, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And my office talked to three different neurologists, and they told us three completely different things. Just completely different.
Oh.
Like, one of which was, it was saying, you know, because, like, it was a question of whether or not medication that an epileptic took could cause a blackout even from consuming something like half a glass of wine. Okay, so this was the question is, would this render a person unconscious? Was part of what we were trying. And then the secondary question was, well, even if it wouldn't render somebody unconscious, would it sufficiently affect their memory such that it would be an explanation for why they have no recollection of events? You know, if it's not unconscious, could it at least be, and blackout isn't right. That's not the right term, because typically people think of that as relating to alcohol, but that's what we were trying to sort out. And three different doctors told us three totally different things. The first one's like, oh no, it's just that epileptics have all of these behavioral issues. So then we went down this whole thing about, oh yeah, there are these studies that link them to being kleptomaniacs, and they have compulsive lying behaviors, which of course, like, if that's, you know, somebody accusing your client of things, then you have to investigate that. So we're like, well, all right, that seems kind of odd, but we should probably follow through with that. And so then we talked to another neurologist, and he's like, I don't know what the hell that guy is talking about.
Oh God.
He's like, you know, he's like, number one, that's not true. Number two, there's no reason that half a glass of wine would cause incapacitation based on the medication list that you've provided me. This person should have been walking, talking, and have been fine. And then the third person's like, okay, yeah, there are these two rogue studies about kleptomania. There's nothing about lying in epilepsy. But it's my opinion, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, that the half glass of wine with that medication would have rendered the person unconscious.
Oh, God. That's all over the map.
So what's the answer there? We're just lawyers. Like, we don't know. You know, it's not like any of us are like, oh, let me just refer back to my medical degree to be able to sort out what the current trends in the treatment of epilepsy are.
And I'm supposing that these people all had similar standing in their, you know, communities.
Oh yeah. Professional. I mean, everybody's board certified. Everybody went to, you know, legitimate educational backgrounds. All of the experts that we consult typically have over a decade of experience in their field.
Wow.
You know, I mean, we're careful with the people that we consult with because we want them to present as credible. And so, you know, it was one of those things that it was sort of like, so is the answer that we just don't call an expert at all?
Okay, well, I have to ask what happened.
So what ended up happening with that case is the charges against our client were ultimately dismissed.
Okay.
For totally unrelated reasons, but they were dismissed like the morning of jury selection. So it was, we had a lot of lunchtime strategy sessions. It was Nate's case, and just talking through, you know, I think that this guy who says that people with epilepsy are all pathological liars is probably the most helpful expert for the defense in this situation. But we don't really think that that's probably true. Mm-hmm. So we're a little uncomfortable putting that up as testimony.
It's an interesting ethical quandary.
Yeah, where we're like that, you know, and plus, like, the other two people that we talked to, one of them just said flat out, no, that's all nonsense. The other one said, well, yeah, there's this little kleptomania quirk, but, you know, so we're like, we have three different answers for how this works. The prosecution in that case actually hadn't noticed up. They had put a toxicologist on their witness list, but not a neurologist. So we weren't sure, you know, we knew that the medication results were going to go in, but we didn't think that the state was going to actually call a neurologist to offer their own opinion. So we were pretty sure that our neurologist's opinion would be the only neurology opinion on the record. And which one do you use?
God.
When you're as equally unqualified as the jury to make that decision, you know, like, I don't know which of these three people is the credible one.
Yes. That's so impossible. That's so frustrating.
You know, and so we've had that. I mean, I've had that a few times too with not guilty by reason of mental defect cases where, you know, somebody, I'd have an expert evaluate my client and they would give me a diagnosis and then the expert for the state will evaluate them and say, well, not only do I not agree with the diagnosis that the defense expert has, I don't believe this person has mental illness at all.
Oh. How does one approach that decision-making about credibility and legitimacy and who's correct? I mean, this really gets to the root of my problem with the jury system is because, let's say, you know, both sides put on totally conflicting scientific testimony and a jury of lay people is supposed to determine which is more credible. And I've heard some accounts from, you know, prior jurors that speak to, oh, well, whomever was basically more personable is the one that they tended to believe. And that's a human instinct, but wow, flawed.
No, and that I think is true. And here's the second layer that you have to remember is, you know, one of the oldest lawyer jokes that exist are that lawyers are people who couldn't get into engineering school because none of us could do hard sciences. You know, like we're not math people, we're not science people. So what you've got is this really constructed format of a question and answer. Mm-hmm. And you've got the only person or people who actually know what they're talking about are the witnesses who are not able to speak freely. And you've got two lawyers who probably, you know, have learned things on like WebMD. I mean, I do more research than that. I read, you know, I ask my experts for the literature that they're going to refer to, and I read it. But just because I read it doesn't mean I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I like to think that I'm a reasonably bright person, but I have no medical training.
Right.
And so, and there's not a lot of, even with continuing legal education, you know, you go to a 2-day seminar, there's maybe an hour and a half of those 2 days that speaks to dealing with medical testimony. And so I'm not sure, even when you as a lawyer work really hard with your expert to make sure that you understand it, it's still kind of the blind leading the blind because you've got lawyers scripting the conversations for jurors, none of whom have any meaningful way to sort out if what the people are saying is true.
Yeah, you know, I'm reminded of Serial and the way they talked about how Adnan Syed's lawyer actually went to an elementary school. In my memory, it was an elementary school, and talked to school children about, you know, various scientific information, I think DNA information when it was new, and tried to explain the science to the children. And anytime a child would say they didn't understand, she would back up and practice it over again. And this was her exercise for getting ready to present really complex scientific testimony to a jury in a palatable and understandable way. And I thought that was interesting, but also a little bit insulting to potential jurors. How do you prepare really complex scientific testimony for a jury of lay people?
So for me, the first thing I do is ask my expert to explain to me to the best of their ability what the three most important things we need to take away from their testimony are. So what are the, you know, if I only want this jury to understand three things, what are those three things? Okay. Mental illness or, you know, spiral fractures can be caused accidentally and not just intentionally or whatever medical, you know, because that's another area, like a hotly, hotly contested area of competing medical testimony deals with shaken baby and abusive head trauma.
Oh, yes.
Where there are some doctors that basically say that's not a thing. And then there are some doctors who say, oh, it's always the thing. And there's a lot of really dueling experts, but I ask my experts to come up with analogies, you know, like, how do you explain this to somebody who's not in your field? What would you do to demonstrate this? I try and bring in as much visual evidence in terms of exhibits that have charts or graphs or demonstrative evidence of any type, so that for the visual thinkers on the jury, there's something they can look at versus hearing just like all of these medical words flying by them quickly. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a mispronouncer. I mispronounce things. And there's nothing more treacherous for me than having to pronounce medical terms, because I can't say any of them. And so I like to have like the charts that show what we're talking about. And so I try and put together a visual component to the testimony with very closely monitored assistance from my expert. And the other thing that I do is I send my experts a draft of not necessarily question per question. Here's what I'm going to ask you, but bullet points in detail about like, here are the areas that I want to cover. And then I say to them, tell me what's wrong with the way that I've organized this. And they almost always have an answer where they're like, you know, they're like, actually, if we can move it around like this, it's going to make more sense to people who are unfamiliar with this. So I take a lot of direction from my experts. I give them tips on testifying, you know, about eye contact and speaking at a reasonable volume and a moderate pace versus speaking too quickly and things. So, I mean, I talk to them about presentation. The other thing is, and this goes back to your point about, you know, personality and likability, is there are particularly, not to knock them, I'm sorry, IT people, but particularly when I need to call a forensic computer expert, I will decide after meeting with people, this person's just not going to be an engaging witness. Right. And I'm sure they're quite qualified at their job, but...
Well, let me ask you, if they lack those social skills, are you concerned more that the jury will be bored or their thoughts will wander and they just won't actively listen? Or are you more concerned that they will deem something to be suspect or uncomfortable about this witness and then discount their testimony?
Both.
Right.
You know, because number one, all right, so I'm going to tell a story now. The first time.
Yes.
The first time I ever tried a case, my first case that had DNA evidence. Okay. Mm-hmm. I was a really young lawyer. It was a shooting case, but an injury case. Nobody had died. I'd been practicing for a couple of years, and I knew almost nothing about DNA. I mean, just nothing. And so I, you know, bought a textbook, like a college textbook, and I sat in on a couple classes since I live in a college town and, you know, tried to somehow consume this, but then had to prepare the cross-examination of this expert. And it was one of those kind of funky partial matches where the result was like 1 in 2,500 versus a clear full-blown DNA match, which is, you know, to the trillions or whatever.
Right.
And I remember watching the person from the crime lab testify, and you know, I was diligent about trying to prepare for it and trying to make sure that I understood it to the extent possible. And I knew that the major point I wanted to pull out of that was, look, this is not an actual match. This is just, this could be a brother, a cousin. It could be another random person, 1 out of 2,500. So I didn't have like really complicated questions about the method of extraction or, you know, reproduction, things like that, which you could really get into the weeds in with cases where you're worried about contamination. But it took her, the expert, over 2 hours just to kind of lay out the building blocks of DNA. And like 3 of the jurors fell asleep.
Oh no.
You know, and so I'm sitting here like writing all of it down frantically. Oh. Because I'm like, okay, I think I understood that. And I look over and I mean, she had just bored the jury to tears. And I wasn't, you know, like I wasn't bored because I was so nervous about having to cross-examine her. But I've seen that. I mean, juries get bored with forensics. Mm. And I'll tell you, my first homicide trial with the investigator on the witness stand who was walking through, you know, they had done the strings to show where the bullets had gone through. And we had the door from that had the bullet holes in it. So this was all set up, which is not quite CSI style, but for it's like,
it sounds,
you know,
very
lo-fi.
Interesting, though.
Yeah,
like, that's the kind of thing.
CSI.
Yeah. You would highlight for a dramatic series.
Right. Like you would think, right?
Yes.
Okay, on TV, that's fun. In court, I was bored out of my skull.
Oh, really?
And I remember sitting there thinking, and my client, who I really got along with, wrote down on a paper, he's like, you didn't tell me court was this boring. You know, and it's like, and this is a homicide trial.
I have to ask.
We both had that reaction.
I mean, it sounds, when you see the 90 seconds of that testimony in a dramatic, like, series, in a legal drama, it is very engaging and compelling. So I'm wondering, is it just that there's so much testimony about physics in general? Is it just they have to get so,
yeah,
like,
it,
okay.
It's like the foundation, that you have to lay the foundation for everything.
Okay.
You know, so it starts with, like, what's blood spatter? And then 17 questions later, we get to, and was there blood spatter in this case?
Right.
There was. Now, let's introduce exhibits 1 through 79, which are all of the photographs that we took. And it just took us another hour and 10 minutes solely to mark those exhibits and get them into evidence.
Oh, that would
be recognize
asleep.
This? Yeah, do you recognize this? Yes, I do. What is it? It's a photograph of the hallway where the shots were fired. All right. Yes, I do. It's another shot of the hallway taken approximately 2 feet south of the one that you just showed me. What's this one? Exhibit 80. It's another shot of the hallway taken 2 more feet south.
Got it. Yeah. That. Okay. Now I'm getting a fuller picture.
Yeah. And that is miserably dull. You know, so I do worry, and it's not, and hopefully anyone that's listened to me talk knows how much I really believe that jurors, number one, are not stupid, number two, want to get things right. Mm-hmm. So when I say that it's boring, that's not a knock on the intelligence of any particular jury. I'm saying, like, my eyes glaze over. I wonder why the hell we can't do this any faster. I want them to get to the point.
Right. Yeah.
And that's a, you know, and that's a very delicate balance to strike even on Cross, is you don't want to go on too long, because if it's subject matter that isn't particularly compelling and is sort of cumbersome or dense in the first place, if your Cross goes on too long, then you probably lose anything effective you did, because you've brought it back to boring. And that's not, I really don't think that's the fault of whoever's directing the witness, whether it be a prosecuting attorney or a defense attorney. I think it's just, whenever you have to lay foundation for that kind of science, it takes a long time and it's dull.
Yeah.
You know, for all you scientists out there, I love that you love it. It's just, for the rest of it, you know, like, I mean, similarly, I spend like 95 hours a week thinking about crime, and a lot of people would find that unappealing. But,
right.
But
a lot of people find the law just as dry and boring.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So it's not, you know, I'm not trying to like talk shit.
Yeah. You know, I don't want to draw us too far off topic again, but I need to ask you, because I've kind of wondered this in the past. You mentioned that, you know, three of your jurors fell asleep on this one case. What do you do as an attorney if you notice that jurors are sleeping?
You immediately ask for a sidebar and you call it to the judge's attention, and the judge gives them a very stern lecture and, you know, bangs the gavel from time to time, and also encourages them to bring caffeinated beverages to be able to stay awake. And if it's a persistent problem, there are usually alternate jurors.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had more than one trial where we've just decided to declare the sleeping juror the ultimate rather than selecting them randomly.
I see.
Yeah, because like I had a case, and for some reason, I don't know how it escaped the attention of the judge and both lawyers and jury selection, but the juror that I'm thinking about worked the night shift.
Oh,
and
shit.
So he would get there and he'd be good until about noon. But then in the afternoon, he started to fall asleep, because of course that was when he usually slept. So we had all missed that. That is now a question I ask every jury panel I ever pick. Does anyone here work nights?
Right.
Does anyone here have an infant at home? Is there anyone here who's experiencing chronic insomnia at this particular time?
Right.
But, you know, so now, like, I actually ask a lot of questions about that because of that experience. But that was what we found out was, yeah, the guy was trying his best, but he, you know, I mean, he just worked night shifts, and by 1:30 or 2, it was the functional equivalent to, you know, midnight for those of us that get up at 5 or 6.
Two questions. One, did you wind up replacing him with an alternate?
Yes.
Okay.
So we discharged him.
And two, how have you ever had someone that had an infant at home, and did that affect their process in the courtroom?
So we get both peremptory strikes, where we can just strike jurors for whatever reason we see fit, as long as it's not like a race based or gender based strike.
Right. Bastion ruling? Is that what I'm thinking of?
Yes. Bastion. Yep. Exactly. So, subject to the bathroom challenges, you know, we can strike pretty much whatever. That's something that I always ask for two reasons. Number one, parents of either gender are probably sleep deprived if they've got an infant at home. Mm-hmm. And number two, if it's a woman in particular, she may be breastfeeding, and it might be uncomfortable for her to have to sit through the trial without having the opportunity to pump.
Yes. Oh, I feel like a terrible woman that did not occur to me. But yes, that would be really uncomfortable.
You know, and so I will, you know, so I will often set it up so that I can, you know, if somebody says, well, yeah, I actually have a 3-month-old, I'll say, I don't mean to ask you a personal question, but are you breastfeeding? And they'll say yes. And I'll say, how often do you typically have to pump? And they'll say, you know, every 2 hours or whatever the answer is. And then I'll look at the judge and say, can we accommodate that? And the judge will either say, yes, we can, and we'll assure that person that, you know, we'll take breaks whenever you become uncomfortable. Or alternatively, I'll move to strike them for cause just because I don't think it's fair to make somebody sit in discomfort and pain because we have a calendar to get through and we can't take breaks.
Right.
And, you know, the courts are very good about accommodating things like that. I mean, you know, I've had people who needed to take breaks because they needed insulin or things on juries. We try to be really good about making sure that that happens. But I always think about it not because, and just to be clear, I'm in no way suggesting that a breastfeeding mother is unqualified to be a juror.
Oh, no,
I'm just suggesting that she would perhaps prefer to do that when she's had 8 hours of sleep and isn't breastfeeding. That she can do her civic duty some other time.
Yeah. My sister is currently breastfeeding with her first baby. And I can tell you that she would be, and so I'm learning about it over the past few months. And I know she would appreciate your thoughtfulness a great deal. I think that's just you looking out.
Yeah. So I just like, it's not as though, oh, I don't want young mothers on my, you know, jury. That's not it. It's just, I think it would suck. And it's actually something as I prepare and hopefully start a family, something that I've given a lot of thought about in terms of when I return from whatever leave I take, what do I want to do with that? Mm-hmm. Because am I going to want to have to take breaks?
Yeah.
During trials as counsel. So
what are you going to do? Well, that's too personal. I'm sorry.
I mean, I think what I'm going to do is there are breast milk banks here in town. Like we're a hippie ass city like that. So,
so God bless Madison.
I do. Yes. Is just do it myself until I'm back to work, you know, do it myself the first 8 to 12 weeks or whatever it is. And then I'll just tap somebody in.
Why aren't wet nurses a thing anymore?
Seriously. Well, yeah. Like
that makes so much sense. Yeah. I don't know why that's not a thing. Like I think people are grossed out these days at the idea of a wet nurse. I'm like, that just sounds very practical.
I agree. I love that.
Yes.
Like, yeah. So yeah. So there are all sorts of things that kind of go into keeping a jury's attention or being aware of what could cause a juror to be less attentive than they might otherwise be. Mm-hmm. If you caught them at a different point in time, you know, same thing with guy on the night shift. Like if he were working days, I'm sure he'd be a perfectly attentive juror, but he's not, he's working nights. And so he's tired.
Right. God, there's so many things you need to be aware of and foresee during jury selection.
Yeah. And it just, you just kind of keep a list. You learn something new every single time and you think, oh, well, I'm glad I asked that question, or, well, I'll remember to ask that in the future because I did not see that coming.
Yeah. Jeez. God, I've missed you.
I know. I'm so happy to talk to you. You're going to have to come on and do a case with us over at the GO headquarters.
Oh, yes, please. You know what? I would fly to Madison for that.
There you go. Perfect.
I'll bring the wine. I'll bring the Prosecco.
There you go. You can bring Prosecco. We'll have some here just in case you forget, you know.
That's good lawyering. That's just foreseeing every conceivable problem. So sorry for derailing you so wildly. I thought we'd stay more on topic, but I just love talking to you so much, and everything you've mentioned, I kind of want to go down a tiny Jessa rabbit hole. Before we wind down, is there anything else about, or should we save the rest of your mental health thoughts and opinions for another episode?
Totally, totally, totally up to you. You know, in terms of, I've had any variety of experiences with psychologists on the stand, but I don't know that any of them tie completely into, I've never had a psychologist as a defendant at trial.
Okay.
I have represented mental health professionals, but those cases resolved short of trial. So I don't know that I have any particularized insight on that, although I will say that whenever you are in trial with a person who is a professional, it does provide some extra challenges for a lawyer.
Really?
Well, yeah, because, you know, doctors, God bless them, they're used to being the ones with all the information and being the ones that make decisions.
Oh, I see. You mean as for a client, there's a unique set of challenges. I see.
Yeah, that they like present, you know, because trial lawyers, look, we're all a pretty alpha group. You know, we have to be. That's sort of the nature of the beast. And having a highly skilled professional as a client who's also used to being an alpha and used to making the decisions and being in control, that can really be a challenging relationship, I think, for both parties, because I imagine that it's incredibly stressful to feel that loss of control as mm-hmm. a professional who's not used to it. And for us, we're kind of like, get out of my way, man. Like, right. let me do it, you know?
Yeah, I run this playground.
Yeah, then we're in my world now. When we leave, we'll be in your world again. But right now we're here. So I can imagine that being defense counsel in our season three hypothetical here would be challenging. I also am not sure I'd ever want to be in a position where I had to ask my defendant's son if he was attracted to the woman that the defendant had moved into the house. Like, that question in particular, I was like, oh, it's so awkward, because of course his like 18-year-old son would be attracted to this movie star. You know what I mean? Or 21-year-old. I don't remember exactly how old your witness was, but like, of course that would be true.
Right. Yeah. Just like everyone. So many uncomfortable moments. I'd love to do a whole episode with you about navigating relationships with clients. And also, maybe a fun-filled episode about your most awkward moments in court.
Oh, yeah, we could definitely do that.
Oh, that would be a winner.
All right. I do have one little 30-second anecdote to tell on that, and it goes hand-in-hand with medical testimony. Perfect. And this was about 10 years ago. It was just a preliminary hearing for a homicide case. Okay, so just very early hearing, not a meaningful hearing, but nonetheless, you know, it's a homicide case. So as a lawyer, you like to not look like an idiot.
Sure.
And the police officer who was the first person to the scene was describing the injuries that he saw. And he's like, you know, there was a gunshot entry wound under rib 3 and rib 4. And there was what appeared to me to be an exit wound. And so on cross, I'm like, well, you know, you don't have any medical, like, you're not a pathologist, you don't have any medical training. He's like, actually, I do have a medical degree. I changed careers.
Oh, damn it.
Well, okay, I guess we're walking away from that as quickly as possible.
Walk it back, Jess. Walk it back.
Yeah. Walk it back. And I was just like, I just kind of stood there for what felt like 10 minutes. I'm sure it was only like a minute, but it felt like 10. I was like, okay, so shifting gears. So, but yeah, what are the odds?
No, totally fair. We all would have stepped into that.
We all would have had
that all over our shoe.
Like, well, no, actually, I do have a medical degree.
Odds.
So
that's brilliant. Okay, so.
So yeah, okay. Well, we'll figure out a different time to do awkward courtroom moments.
Yes. All right. I'm suddenly very excited about this.
And then you need to pick out a case that you'll come on getting off and analyze with us. It'll be fun.
Okay. I'm very into this.
Good.
Okay. Well, Jessa, until next time, which I hope will be very soon, I'm going to sign off with you. I adore you, and I really have missed you, and you're such a favorite that not only of, you know, the deliberations audience, but of me personally. So
this is back at
a treat. I realized I signed off without letting her plug her show, so I will do it myself.
Guys, if you're not already doing it, listen to Getting Off. Search for Getting Off anywhere you get your podcasts. It's an entertaining, insightful glimpse into the legal world that will change the way you experience true crime. Find Jessa and Nick on Twitter at Getting Off Pod and join the conversation in the Getting Off podcast group. On next week's deliberations, the state is laying out its case for the jury. I hope to see you then. Bye.